Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. This next guest is so generous and awesome. He had actually come on to record about a few months ago, and unfortunately, due to technological difficulties, I lost the whole freaking podcast. And so we're back at it again, and in the meantime, he had a house fire. This guest, he is a physician. He is a cardiologist from Northern California, and he is a blogger that I found courtesy of an extremely lengthy blog role from Physician on Fire. He is someone who is passionate about his family. He's passionate and playing around with the idea of retiring early, but doesn't seem quite sure yet. So we're going to talk about that quite a bit. He's 5-6 years into being an attending doc, and he is well on his way to financial independence. Please help me welcome EJ from Dad's Dollars and Debts. Welcome back, EJ.
Thank you. Nice to be back. And so soon, you know. So thanks for having me on your on your podcast twice.
Well, thank you for coming back, even though people couldn't hear the first conversation. So we had to do it all over again. And thank you so much for that, considering everything that you've been through. I'm curious. I mentioned in the introduction about having a house fire, and so you live in Northern California, as I mentioned. I would love just to dive into that, to have everyone kind of hear what happened with your house fire, and maybe even think about some of the financial stuff. So tell us about that, EJ. What happened with the fire?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was quite unbelievable. You know, that weekend was just a normal weekend, and we had hung out and done our usual things. We'd had my in-laws over Saturday night and some friends over Sunday, and the only thing unusual were the winds were quite hard and fast, and they were coming from the valley instead of from the ocean. So it felt weird, but I'd never grown up here. I never thought of fires being something that actually could happen in a somewhat suburban sprawl. You know, I always thought, oh, those are for the people living out in the country.
Yeah.
And so it was windy. I saw one of the trees was swaying. I said, you know, I looked at my wife. I said, that tree's probably going to come down. We should cut it, you know, after tomorrow. So we went along with our day, and that night, sure enough, at 10 o'clock, that tree came down. I said, well, this is weird, but, you know, still didn't think fire. Ended up going to bed finally at about 1 a.m. just because it was so windy, I couldn't fall asleep. And I looked out my window, and there was actually an orange glow. And I had no clue. I didn't even register it, because by that point, I was tired. It was 1 a.m. I had to go to work the next day. And I passed out. At 2 a.m., someone who I have no idea who it was, knocked on the door. You know, my power was gone. So I run downstairs and I'm like, someone's banging on the door. I open it up and they rush at me and I slam the door. I'm like, who are you? What are you doing? And there was a teenager and his mom, and they were like, you got to get out of here. There's fire all around us. so sure enough, I stepped outside and there was fire. I mean, you could see it kind of pretty much all around us. So ran upstairs, woke up my wife. She grabbed the kid. We ran downstairs, opened the garage door, pulled the car out, put the kid in the car. My wife runs back in, grabs a few things, and then we just take off. And luckily, right as we were pulling out, someone had texted me, a friend had texted me and said, hey, I hear there's evacuations. If you want to come here, you're welcome, you know, to come stay with us that night. So on the way down, you know, there's embers flying, and there was a car on fire on the interstate. I mean, it was crazy, unbelievable stuff. So once you kind of get over the initial shock, you know, the next day I was like, well, I think our house probably burned down because we couldn't get back up here, but the heat alarm had gone off in our attic. We figured the house had burned down. So drove back into town to try to find an apartment and then started doing all the things you have to do, call insurance, you know, call your job, figure out all the logistics of it. So it was crazy. Never expected it. It probably, though, is probably the best financial thing that could have happened. You know, you hear people light their failing businesses on fire to get the insurance check. And I mean, I can tell you that if you're well insured, and this is a case in point for being insured for those things that you never expect to happen, that you can come out financially ahead if you're, you know, intelligent enough not to take it all and blow it on Louis Vuitton bags and Teslas.
So was it, for you, I'm guessing you probably already had disability insurance and life insurance and those kinds of things in place. Did that change your perspective, you know, on those things where, you know, gosh, I want to get more for just in case, or it's like, ah, no, I'm kind of covered. You know, did that change your perspective at all in going
it
through
didn't
that?
Yeah, it didn't change my perspective on the life insurance and the disability, because I, you know, anyone who kind of reads financial blogs and books and learns about this stuff, hopefully is well insured. What it did change was my desire to get earthquake insurance. So I actually, the fire insurance is just covered under normal home policy. And I was lucky to have an agent, you know, that gave me the policy I had, because I wasn't intelligent enough to kind of pick it. And then the earthquake insurance I didn't get. I was like, what's the likelihood of an earthquake? But now I realize if we'd had an earthquake instead of fire, I would have been screwed. There would have been no, it would have been a very tough financial burden to bear if we had lost everything we lost without insurance paying for it. So if you're in a flood zone, get flood insurance. If you're in an earthquake zone, pay the extra couple grand and get earthquake insurance. I think, you know, when you've kind of lived through one of these crazy, unexpected natural disasters, it makes you appreciate having that. As far as disability in life, yeah, I mean, I think if you're not insured, you should think about it, because if someone had knocked on our door at 2 o'clock, I think the house burned by 3, maybe 4 o'clock.
Oh my gosh, wow.
There's no guarantee, you know, either of us would be here, and I think 22 people lost their lives, so, in our community.
That's nuts. And so, wow. Well, with that all in mind, being a physician, being a cardiologist, were you kind of seeing a lot of patients afterwards, you know, with various issues because of the fire, you know, did that, or were you just having to take care of yourself and your family, you know, take a week or two off, you know, what happened logistically kind of the first few weeks?
And so we were fortunate that our hospital didn't burn down. It was close. There's unfortunately a retirement mobile home community right behind the hospital, and that burned. It's currently leveled, and they've removed all the debris. But so the firefighters and the staff here at the hospital were quite amazing, because they evacuated everyone at, you know, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. They were moving patients to different parts of the city and different parts of the state, honestly. So it took a week for the clinics to open up, and then it took another 4 weeks for the hospital to open up because of all the smoke damage from being so close to the fire. And in that time, you know, 3 out of 6 of us cardiologists lost our homes.
Wow.
So in that first week, the other cardiologists kind of chipped in, went to other facilities to help see our patients. And then when we came back a week later, it was kind of a slow trickle. So we came in, you know, and did more telephone visits than anything else, because not only were we displaced, everyone else was displaced. You know, all our patients were evacuated, even if their homes didn't burn, because there was so much smoke and the fires weren't contained. So in that initial period, I'd say the first 3-4 weeks, it wasn't too busy. But then people started coming in, and a lot of people, since the fires, have had chest pains or palpitations or anxiety, some with breathing problems. And I suspect that, you know, there's a lot of kind of things that happen both mentally and physically, you know, that are still impacting people.
I can only imagine. Well, with that, that kind of behind us, I'd love to know, dig a little bit more into your journey in terms of where you grew up. Did you grow up in California, or where did you grow up?
No, I'm a southerner at heart, so I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, in the 1980s and 90s. It wasn't quite the metropolitan hipster haven it is today. and just grew up, yeah, in the South as an immigrant kid. And had a family, you know, a brother, 2 parents. We moved from Iran when I was four, so when I was real little, and stayed there, and they're still there. kind of hopped around after that, you know, for college, med school, residency, finally came back for fellowship, and then ended up moving for my attending years, both to New Orleans for a few years and then now out to Northern California.
And are your folks physicians? How did they end up making it to the States, and what were your influences for getting into medicine?
Yeah, so my dad is a physician, and I think it's kind of one of those things where if your dad's a firefighter or a cop, you kind of end up being a firefighter or a cop. So I had a father who was a physician. My grandfather, great-grandfather was a physician. Mm-hmm. And so when they left Iran post-revolution, they just realized that things weren't improving. There was a war with Iraq, and they said, all right, time to go. And actually, I think about them when I think about the fire, because we lost everything, but it was kind of like, we're still pretty well set, you know, because we're Americans and we understand the culture and we have jobs. For them, they left. They were able to bring some things, but it was to a whole new kind of world. And growing up, you know, my father always kind of put in my head that being a doctor was a good job. He gave me the option, doctor or lawyer. I don't think he would have been too excited if I was a poet or some other liberal arts degree. But from there, I decided medicine was the way to go. I think I was always good at science, and I'm not very confrontational, so lawyer didn't seem like a very, very prudent path. And that's how I ended up, where we are today.
So I've talked about this before a few times, and I think we talked about it in the previous time that we lost the recording for. But I'm curious to dig into what it's like coming from that immigrant background when it comes to money. You know, were your folks someone that were really into saving and were tight about saving? You know, what was that like growing up for you? Or were they more, you know, had the American mindset of spending and getting, you know, the big house and those kinds of things?
So they had, I think, more the American mindset. You know, they came from an affluent position to somewhere where they had to kind of rebuild and restart, but they wanted to maintain that quality of life. So they often would, you know, have big parties and have all their friends over, which was great growing up, and work towards the bigger house. I mean, their house that they currently live in is bigger than mine that burnt down, even though it's just two of them, and having the nice things in life. That being said, my mom was always telling me, you know, you should learn to save, you should not spend all your money, you know, don't go spend $20 at the arcade, and I didn't listen to her. I mean, I did not save a single dollar growing up, despite her constantly telling me how to do that. And so I grew up spending, and I grew up enjoying life. I never really wanted anything too fancy. It's not like I came out and wanted a Corvette when I came out of work or anything like that, but I definitely didn't worry about money coming in and money going out. I figured, hey, I earn a high income, it'll be okay. You know, I can do it all. I can buy these things and save for retirement.
So it felt like it would just kind of come naturally. You weren't really having to save at all.
Big announcement here. Have you ever wanted to open your own cash-based insurance-free practice? If the answer is yes, then I invite you to attend a special workshop led by my friend, Dr. Mike Wu-Ming, who was on the podcast in late 2017. He is a physician entrepreneur. He has been quietly teaching physicians a special type of medical practice with cash pay only. You don't have to deal with insurance anymore. He calls them paradise practices. And it's not only wildly popular for patients, but for the physician owners, because it gives you freedom to work less while making more. Mike and his team, he's been doing this himself, and you can learn his systems, how to pay these cash pay practices. And so he wants to give you, my friends, a special discount when you attend his exclusive workshop. So if this resonates with you, if this is something that you want to look into, check out this link, paradiseprpracticeworkshop.com/freedom. And you're going to get $100 off your registration. Make sure to go to paradisepracticeworkshop.com/freedom and get $100 off your registration. Go there now.
So when you, where'd you go to undergrad? Where was that?
I went to George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Is that a private or public?
It's private. Yeah, it's private. It was the most expensive private school, I think, at the time, and still may be.
Hmm. So why there?
Yeah, so not pretty bright. my brother was going there. So, you know, he was 2 years older. He'd gotten in, and I'd gotten in there, and then I think University of Tennessee, which had given me a decent scholarship. And I was ready to get out of the South. You know, I love the South, but I think there are times where I go in there and I'm engrossed in kind of the mindset, and I'm like, all right, I need a change. So going to University of Tennessee didn't seem like it was going to be culturally what I wanted. So Washington, D.C. it was.
So what tell me more about that. You know, what about the culture do you feel didn't fit you?
It's funny because now I think the culture fits me more, but growing up, I think it was just being, you know, an Iranian kid with a funny name in a mostly white area with people who sometimes made, you know, not so nice comments growing up. And I think about this because, you know, bullying comes up a lot in society now. And obviously we have these tragic school shootings, especially the Parkland one and the one in Maryland yesterday. There was another school shooting. And I wonder, has anything changed in the sense of have we made any progress in bullying, or is it actually getting worse? And I think that was part of it. I think there was the idea of going, not that D.C. is the Northeast, but going to a big metropolitan city and living in a city for college and trying that out.
Interesting. So you get there and you end up going to medical school. By the time you're getting through medical school, how much debt did you have at that point? Was it quite a bit, or were your parents helping out in this time period? You know.
They did help out, yeah. I mean, they paid for some college, and I actually did college in 3 years, and I was an RA. So I took steps to kind of decrease my cost of college. I think my parents spent about $50,000 for me in college, and I spent about $25,000. So that was after college where I had debt. And then in medical school, I did get into GW, but I also got into University of Tennessee in Memphis. And at that point, was a little wiser and realized it would cost me twice as much to go to school at GW in D.C., so I went to University of Tennessee in Memphis, and so when I came out of med school, you know, it only cost me, I think tuition at that point was $10,000 a year when I started, and by the time I graduated, it was $16,000. Yeah, so I came out with $188,000 total combined college and med school debt, and that was with me maximizing my loans just so I could have a fun quality of life, probably more than I needed.
Right. So, as you're now in residency, at what point, I guess, did you have a mind shift change? You know, because it sounds like you weren't too frugal, but you weren't like, you know, buying Corvettes or anything crazy. You know, so at what point did kind of a light switch flip for you?
It really happened when I became an attending. So even in residency, I hadn't contributed at all to my retirement account, zero. And I think I justified it because I was living in Boston. I said, well, I'm not making that much, you know, and I live in a high-cost living area. And then in fellowship, I finally got smart and at least contributed enough for the match. But then still, I got out of fellowship and started doing some locums work while I was waiting for my full-time gig to kind of fall into place. And I would make good money, and I'd come in. My wife and I would go to $200-$300 dinners. So I think it was about 6 months in, I looked at our debt, and we had quite a bit of debt. You know, not only did I have student loans, my wife had student loans from two master's programs, and we had a wedding we had just had, which was expensive in the mid-five figures. We had been in Argentina for a year and traveled around a lot, so we had credit card debt in the low five figures. So we were not by any means, you know, on the track to a positive net worth. So one day it just clicked. I think it was 6 months out when I was practicing, and I was like, we got to do something different because this is not going to be sustainable. And at that point, you know, I was an attending, and I realized kind of what work was going to be going forward, and that maybe I don't want to do this for 30 years full time. So I started tracking our net worth. You know, every month on an Excel sheet, I would have a monthly meeting with my wife and say, all right, here's where we are. And she would kind of either say okay or roll her eyes. You know, I think she's less motivated than I am, but she knows that I'm motivated, so we're going to be okay.
So tell me about those conversations with your wife. It sounds like it's something where she's not as passionate as you are, you know, about this subject. So yeah. How has that evolved?
I mean, it's still the same way. I think that the fire particularly and the insurance money demonstrated to both of us that all my reading has kind of helped. You know, it when we got a huge check, I mean, and I'm talking over $500,000 just for our possessions, I had to decide what to do with it. And you can imagine that would be quite overwhelming if you hadn't been doing a lot of reading. So that knowledge that I gained through years of reading allowed me to kind of allocate money where we needed to, pay off debt, things like that. But month to month, you know, we stopped having our meetings. I kind of tell her when we hit big milestones. Hmm. And then she's still not eager about it. She thinks I'm too frugal at times, I think now.
What do you think?
But she by no means spends a lot. Excuse me. I think that I am. I think it's not so much, I wouldn't say I'm cheap because I like to spend money on food and clothes and I don't mind spending money on nice things. I just don't have a desire for them as much as I used to. And I think that's evolved over the last year and a half where I'm not buying possessions as much. And I think it's because I realized, hey, the more I save, the more freedom I have in 5 or 10 years. And while we're fine working now, who knows where we'll be in 10 years. Someone could get sick, your house could burn down, you could lose a loved one. Mm-hmm. Whereas my wife is still kind of, she doesn't spend a lot of money. I mean, if you look at some of my colleagues and friends, you know, they spend much more than she does. But she is like, well, I'm still recuperating my life and, you know, I'm still kind of regaining some of the things I lost. And I think that's valid. Everyone has to process what happened separately. Now, I think when we were more in debt, and currently we're actually debt-free, I think I paid off my last mortgage check yesterday, but we might take out a construction loan to build. So it's kind of like a period where I'm debt-free. She, you know, she was on board with the idea of, okay, yeah, we have to pay this off. We should be watching our spending. And I think now we're just kind of both, you know, in a different place, and we'll see where we are in another 6 months. I'm not eager to push anything or have a strong discussion about frugality because it's kind of unnecessary. You know, we're hitting our goals. So why stress a relationship if you're hitting your goals?
Right. Well, I think and that's just being real, right? You know, I think often in a relationship, like me and my wife, you know, I'm more the frugal one. Although my frugality is in areas that are the ones that aren't important to me, right? Like, I'm not a big clothes shopper. That's not something important to me. I would rather, you know, eat a little less and live a little leaner, not have a full pantry. My wife loves having a full pantry and a full fridge. So it's just kind of a different mentality. But I don't mind spending money when it comes to reinvesting in business and, you know, those kinds of things that I can see a return on my money potentially. Not all of them work out, though. So
not all of them. And that's where we are with the home building right now. You know, we're meeting with the builder, and my wife's like, why are we doing this? It's a headache. And I'm like, well, we could potentially double our profit. And it's like, yeah, you might not, but it's unlikely we're going to lose money, so we might as well put up with the headache just if it's going to be we may not have an opportunity like this again, you know?
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting. You think about it, as a cardiologist, I think most cardiologists earn, what, $400K plus?
About that, yeah, four plus, yeah.
Four plus?
If you're in academics, maybe
$350. And so, you had to have a longer fellowship, of course, you know, to get there. And then you've been diligent about paying off your student loans, and you just paid off your mortgage. So, I mean, you can be completely debt-free. That is awesome, considering the delay to get there, right, and compounding interest and all of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I will be honest,
I wouldn't have gotten there without the fire. So it would have taken another 10 years, I think, with my current plan.
And you had mentioned earlier books that impacted you, that you've been doing a lot of reading. I would love to know, EJ, you know, what are the one or two or three books that really you think would be helpful to us to pick up and check out?
So the one and only book thus far I've asked my wife to read is The White Coat Investor Financial Guide book. And I think that's just a nice overall summary of things high earners should be thinking about. I do think it's well written, and I think it provides information succinctly. If you want to know how to kind of live and become wealthy, then I think The Millionaire Next Door, which is a classic, is a very good book to just kind of reframe your vision of what wealth should be. That maybe it's not the Elon Musk's out there, granted he's wealthy, but more the guy who's saved a lot of money over time and now doesn't have to work and drives his Camry or his pickup truck and enjoys his life or her life.
And it sounds like, I often say there's kind of two different kinds of avatars out there in terms of the financially successful people that I see. Doctor, in terms of physicians, doctor piles of cash and doctor rivers of income. I'm guessing you probably are more the former of the piles of cash. But tell us more, you know, what do you think of those two you lie in?
I'm definitely going for a piles of cash mentality. I always said, well, if I can accumulate $2.5 million, then I can definitely cut back and probably not have to work at that point, be financially independent. $2 million may cut it too, but I do appreciate and realize that it would be nice to have the rivers of income. I just don't have the desire or wherewithal right now to try to figure out how to get rivers of income. I know a lot of people do it in different ways, real estate, dividend investing, you know, stocks that pay dividends, maybe side business like the blog. But I just feel like if I can just kind of accumulate a big pile of cash, especially with my income, then that's going to put me in a place where I should be okay and even be able to weather big drops in the market and still be financially free.
So tell me about that. You mentioned the number $2.5 million. Tell me about that number. Why that number?
So, you know, I assume that my family can live on $60,000 post-taxes. I haven't done the math recently, but that's the number that popped out in my head. See, I used to have these really well written down on a computer that was since lost. But so if you take $2.5 million and you divide it by 25, you get about $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty straightforward and set rule kind of that people talk about 25 times your annual spending. So in reality, maybe I'd need a little bit more to cover taxes.
Right.
But I think $100,000 would be adequate, you know, and if honestly, if we cut spending back, and I'm not sure where else our spending will fall. I know where it used to fall per month, but right now we're still in kind of the state of flux where we're replacing things. So,
yes.
You know, we may spend less than that. We may be spending $60,000 a year. Particularly if you get to a point where you don't have to pay for disability and term life, if you've paid for your kids' college, which I'd like to do at least partially, if not fully, then I think you can really cut back on some of these expenses.
Well, the point I often make to folks is that just like you look at in your situation, your stuff changes, stuff happens, right? And when someone looks at a pile of cash like that, like to me, with a lot of different assets, whether it's real estate or other investments, they've appreciated a lot the last 10 years, right? You know, it's been pretty much, you know, a 45-degree angle heading upwards with a few little squiggles along the way. And so I'm curious to think of when you look at that number, do you make any adjustments for that the fact that a house can burn down or you can be in a car accident or, you know, health or something like that can happen along the way? You know, how do you factor those kinds of things into that number?
I think it goes down to, you know, if you can do a Mr. Money Mustache type thing and flex those frugal spending muscles. I'd like to think we can, but I think, you know, human nature is one where habits are hard to change. So I think that's where I've started trying to change some of my habits. And then if a situation like that happens, hopefully you've planned forward enough to where you have enough money to cover all of those. Now, I was thinking of this yesterday, like my term life. I think we have $3 million term life for my wife and I. So that in my mind said, okay, if I die, I need $3 million so my wife can pay the mortgage, pay the student debts, pay for my kids' college, and live a comfortable life going forward. Now, she could go back to work, but I'd like her at least not to have to worry for a while. So if my number then was $3 million, and now I don't have student debt, my son's college is pretty adequately paid for, I think, at this point. And right now I don't have a mortgage. Now, granted, I probably will have one at some point, not to the extent that I had, because I don't think we're going to live in such a big house again. If you take those into account, then I think if $3 million was enough before, then it's surely enough now. So $2.5 is probably enough. And some of those things, like, yeah, if I'm disabled, until I'm at a point where I feel like I can get rid of my disability insurance, I'll have that to kind of help me out. And I do have a friend who was disabled for a while, so I definitely appreciate how freak things can happen, and his was definitely a freak accident. So, yeah, it's important to kind of stay, I guess, solvent. And when it comes to things like early retirement versus working part-time, I used to be more of the camp of, hey, maybe I'd want to retire early, and now I'm leaning more towards, well, even if I one day don't want to have a job at an institution, doing locums work, you know, a few months out of the year, a few weeks out of the year would be good, because then you at least maintain your license and your ability to practice, and you're not giving that up, you know. Some early retirees, a lot of them are in tech, and I think if you haven't coded for 5 years and you want to go back and code, you can get a job. Unfortunately, as a doctor, that's not the case. So you kind of got to keep it going.
That's awesome. Very good. Well, I know that, part of this passion, as I mentioned, is your blog, which you have at dadsdollarsdebts.com. Triple D, dadsdollarsdebts.com. Tell us a little bit about the blog and maybe a few popular posts that might be good for folks to check out.
So, you know, I started it a little over a year ago. Maybe it's been a year and a half. And it was just kind of something I'd thought about doing for 3 or 4 years. finally started doing it. It's done okay. I mean, I wouldn't say I've hit it out of the ballpark like some of your prior guests, but I get maybe 200 views a day, so I feel like that's reasonable. You know, it talks mainly about personal finance, some about lifestyle. You know, by no means am I a minimalist, so I try to discuss like living a moderate life, maybe moderatism as opposed to minimalism, and also about kind of the fire and insurance stuff for the last few months, you know, how that's panned out. That was not initially the plan. What I don't talk about as much, which I thought I would, was being a father and raising a kid, but I think that's because I just feel like there's got to be some separation between your child's life on the internet and your own. So I don't want to put a lot of stuff out there on him, and then in the future he's like, Dad, why did you have that out there? which is weird to think, but that's the way it is. As far as some good posts, you know, I think I have one about being a moderatist and not a minimalist. I think that's a good one. I have another post about how things change, so something, it's called entropy, that everything changes. And I think that's one of those things where, you, as I said, you can predict, or you can plan, but you can't predict. So it's good to plan life, but you have to be able to roll with the things that are out of your control. For physicians, I have a couple of posts up there, and, you know, if people click on the doctor's category, they can look at that and see what's on there. And then I have some things on decluttering, you know, decluttering your email and your kind of online world, decluttering your house. A fire is definitely a good way to do that, but probably not the preferred method. And things like that. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff on there.
Awesome. Very good. Well, we'll make sure to check that out, everybody. We'll have those in the show notes and the links on the podcast. So make sure to check out those specific posts. And EJ, as we kind of wrap up this interview, I'd love to know and ponder this question. If you could step back into the past, and you're not a practicing physician, you're sitting down with a younger EJ, an EJ that is a first-year resident. He's just been matched out of medical school. What advice would you give to him?
I would say stop spending so much money. I mean, I don't regret going out as much as I did, but maybe I didn't have to buy rounds for all my friends as frequently as I did. So start saving, stop spending, put some money in that 401k or IRA starting from day one. and just let it grow, and don't have a big wedding.
Yeah, so what kind of wedding would you have? I'm curious.
Well, we had two weddings. So before we went to Argentina, we got married. We had a legal wedding at a courthouse with my friend's mom was a judge, and she did it. And then a small party with the family at my brother's house, and then we went to a bar with some friends and just had a great night. You know, that was awesome. And probably cost, you know, a couple $100. Then we went to Argentina, and when we came back, we had the big blowout wedding with like 200 people in Boston with a beautiful view for everyone, you know, for all the family, the extended family, the friends of family. And that put us back mid five figures and caused a lot of stress probably when we were in Argentina, kind of thinking about saving and planning for it. And then afterwards, you know, we had to pay it off. So, mm-hmm. Don't do it. The one we fondly remember is the first one. The second one, we just kind of, it's a footnote or a side note.
Good advice. I love it. And any other closing thoughts, my friend, that you want to leave with us?
No, I mean, I appreciate you taking the time. I think, you know, keep on keeping on and keep on saving. And remember that it's small and slow steps that lead to wealth. It's not something that happens overnight. And while we are all on this path, it's worth it, because I think I can tell you, once you become more financially independent, which has happened to me despite all the stress in the last 6 months, a huge weight is kind of lifted off your shoulders. So if you can get debt free, you will feel much better for it, and it's worth every bit of effort to get there.
Well, it gives you options, right? I mean, that's the way I think of it, that, you know, let's say you wanted to work part-time, that perhaps you have the option now to do that if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's awesome. So
it is nice. It's a nice way to be, yeah.
Well, and I encourage everyone, I think, as you listen to EJ's story, as you check out his blog, you know, I think no matter where you're at in your financial journey and learning, you know, I think kind of what he said, just add another piece, add another layer. You don't have to know everything today. I often hear from physicians that they never learned this stuff in medical school.
Yeah.
But you know what? They don't teach it in business school either, to be honest.
Yeah,
so
that's funny, yeah.
It's certainly you get some exposure, but you don't get the practicality that you do in terms of how it is. So learn from EJ. Check out the blog. Anything else, EJ?
Nope, that's it. Thank you. Dave, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
All right, EJ. Well, thank you so much for being with us. If people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you?
EJ@dadsdollarsdebts.com.
Bam. There you go. All right, my friends. Well, that wraps it up for today. In the next podcast, I would love to tell your story. Let's make sure to connect. You can contact me, Dave, at drfreedompodcast.com or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. And certainly want to thank you so much for joining us today. It means so much to have you take time out of your busy and compressed schedule. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.
Big announcement here. Have you ever wanted to open your own cash-based insurance-free practice? If the answer is yes, then I invite you to attend a special workshop led by my friend, Dr. Mike Wu-Ming, who was on the podcast in late 2017. He is a physician entrepreneur. He has been quietly teaching physicians a special type of medical practice with cash pay only. You don't have to deal with insurance anymore. He calls them paradise practices. And it's not only wildly popular for patients, but for the physician owners, because it gives you freedom to work less while making more. Mike and his team, he's been doing this himself, and you can learn his systems, how to pay these cash pay practices. And so he wants to give you, my friends, a special discount when you attend his exclusive workshop. So if this resonates with you, if this is something that you want to look into, check out this link, paradiseprecticeworkshop.com/freedom. And you're going to get $100 off your registration. Make sure to go to paradiseprecticeworkshop.com/freedom and get $100 off your registration. Go there now.